Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. I'm not alone in saying this, but I'm pretty sure that 2015 is the year of Filipino food in Los Angeles, which is an odd thing to say, considering that Los Angeles has been home to a considerable Filipino-American population for decades. The 2010 census tells us that Filipino-Americans are the second largest Asian demographic in LA after Chinese. There are more people who self-identify as Filipinos than Koreans, Vietnamese, and Thai. And while we all line up for galbi and pad-siu, Filipino food has largely stayed out of sight. This isn't the first time I've posed this question on Good Food, but I hope it's the last. Is it finally time for the Filipino food boom? Chase and Chad Valencia are a team of brothers starting to bring food from their family onto the radar of LA eaters. For years, they honed their skills in LA's best eateries. Chase on the operations side at Wolfgang Puck Catering, and Chad in the kitchen at places like Canale, Squirrel, and Elysian. Lhasa is their once-a-month pop-up that's a mashup of California and the Philippines. Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
It's so great to have you here.
Happy to be here.
Excited.
I think a lot of people don't understand the depth of Filipino cooks and service staff in Los Angeles restaurants.
Right.
There's a lot.
There's a lot.
There's a lot.
And yet, until now, aside from the mom and pop places that we see in Philippine Town, hasn't really been anybody that's jumped onto the radar in a more modern way. Why do you think that is?
I think there's some various reasons to that. One large part would be the sense of it's a cultural thing. It's assimilation into the American culture and the American way of life. With that in mind, within our community, in a food sense, we cooked and prepared food, not necessarily think of showcasing and introducing it to non-Filipinos or to Los Angelinos, per se. Mainly, we cooked out of necessity within the community, just putting the food out for our community who's craving Filipino food. That, along with the fact that a lot of Filipino households cooked a lot of Filipino food, and why am I going to eat Filipino food outside of my home when, let's say, my aunt cooks the best, my mom cooks the best?
I've read so much about this. Amy Scattergood, who's now the LA Times food editor, in 2010 wrote this article that I think sort of perked everybody's interest in. She called it a deeply flavorful melange of foods that seem to resist assimilation into mainstream culture, thriving in home kitchens but stubbornly remaining there. Do you think that there's something inherent in the flavor profile that required us to develop a more sophisticated palate to accept it?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, I think those flavors exist in Thai food and Vietnamese food. And really, for me, I think it was a generational thing. Mm-hmm. Most of the chefs up to this point are of our parents' generation, and, you know, they dealt with assimilation. I mean, for instance, our father migrated to San Francisco from the Philippines in the late 70s, and the first thing he did to get a job was get rid of his accent. He took linguistics classes to get rid of his accent. Like, I think that shows kind of like, okay, Filipino thing stays at home. I'm here to be an American. Whereas we're born here, born into that culture at home, and being in the industry, now there's an opportunity for us to show our culture and our voice, you know? I've spent the last 13 years cooking California cuisine, Mediterranean, not Filipino food, but I've grown up eating that my whole life. So this is that connection for us, you know, and that's authentic to us.
It's interesting. I went to one of your Lhasa pop-ups at Elysian. First of all, I wanted to ask you, what does Lhasa have a particular meaning?
Yes, Lhasa in Tagalog means taste or flavor. And based on context, I thought about how meaningful the word Lhasa was to our family and in the Philippine household, food is such an important thing that the flavor of something, the taste of something kind of sets the tone of, let's say, a family party or family gathering, you know? And so for me, it was so very sentimental, you know? And also for non-Filipinos, it was accessible in a way.
Yeah, easy to say.
Easy to say,
easy to remember, right.
So I want to go back to the flavor of the food. For me personally, even being an omnivorous kid growing up in LA, the first bites of Filipino food were hard when I was younger. Because you say it's like Thai food and Vietnamese food, but those have a sweetness that isn't as prevalent in the Philippine palate, right?
Absolutely. I think with Filipino food, there is a sense of really a lot of souring agents. There's a lot of vinegar. We would get fried fish
and you just dip it in vinegar
and raw sugarcane vinegar.
And white distilled vinegar or sugarcane vinegar or coconut vinegar. But yeah, it's definitely bold and loud and not balanced compared to the Western palate, I guess.
And bitterness. There's a bitterness and there's a funk level.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So it was really interesting for me when I ate at Lhasa because I kind of felt like it was almost too Western in a way that I was expecting more funk. Are you guys trying to lead people down a path gently?
Exactly. That's exactly it. I mean, we've done a lot of homework. I mean, Lhasa's, we've only been doing pop-ups for the last couple of years, but we've been researching Filipino food's existence in America in the last 5 to 6 years, you know? And what we saw being unsuccessful was just that straightforward traditional stuff, not making it because of that. So we thought, all right, if we can keep it soulful and if for the Filipinos it's relatable and there's that sentiment there and then at the same time be accessible to people that have never had Filipino food, then, you know, I think that's going to be our approach.
So what are some of the classics that are just pan-Filipino that you feel you want to introduce, and maybe what are some that you feel are too similar to other cuisines that we already embrace that you'd rather hold back on and show something else?
Well, like, so most of our noodle dishes definitely are in our cuisine by way of China.
And these are pancit.
Pancit, yes. And there's so many varieties and variations of pancit. And a lot of them are very straightforward, like in the wok with vegetables, chop suey, a touch of soy sauce, a touch of acid, a touch of this. So,
and is it an egg-based noodle, a water-based wheat noodle, or is it a rice noodle?
All three of those, actually. They all exist. There's canton egg noodle, then there's wheat noodle, and then, you know, vermicelli, there's like the palabok, mm-hmm. which is this shrimp and pork-based sauce. Like, we haven't touched on that one yet. And like,
it's one of my favorites,
that's
too.
One of our favorites. But see, that's the other thing, too, is like, there's got to be the right time to, like,
right.
unleash. Especially because, in essence, we're twisting classics or doing our take on classics. It's like, we don't want to let that plateau, you know? We got to keep challenging ourselves. So sometimes it's, for us at least, it's like a little bit of that and a little bit of trying to make new ideas, new food, new dishes with the flavor profile, you know?
Are you going to start putting like one or two dishes on the menu?
That are a little gnarlier?
Yeah, for those of us that are ready for the gnarly.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Yeah, I mean,
are you ever going to serve balut?
We'll see. We'll visit that.
Yeah,
you know,
that one's...
Describe what it is.
It's a duck embryo. It's a hard-boiled duck embryo. You crack it open, you put salt and vinegar on it, you suck the juice out, and then you eat the embryo.
But the duck is...
It's formed.
It's formed. There's some development in there.
Yeah, so there's a baby duck in there.
Yeah, you see the beak.
It's not just the
I actually, I just had it. I was in the Philippines in March, and I had it duck embryo adobo.
I don't think I've ever heard of that before.
Yeah, see, people adoboed it. But,
So adobo, you sort of said the magic word, which I think is like the word that everybody knows.
Right.
What is adobo?
Adobo is anything stewed or simmered in vinegar, soy sauce, bay leaf, onion, garlic, black peppercorn. It's like we've done adobo octopus, where it's braised in like a very straightforward soy vinegar adobo, classic adobo, so that that piece of octopus carries that essence. And then we sear it hard so it's crisp and tender. And there's not, it's not sitting in that liquid, but the essence is there. And like that technique is true to the traditional thing, but it's definitely not just one pot.
So where are we going to see Lhasa for the next little while?
We're going to hang out at Elysian until we become brick and mortar. And we're working very, very, very hard on that right now.
Well, it's been really wonderful having you here. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having us.
Brothers Chad and Chase Valencia are the duo behind Lhasa, a monthly Filipino-inspired pop-up at Elysian. Their next dinner's this Friday, July 31st. But follow them on social to find out how to get a reservation. We've got links to Lhasa's website and social media on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. In downtown LA, you can find another Filipino-inspired menu at Rice Bar. It is the tiny, and I mean 275 square feet tiny, restaurant where Chef Charles Olalia and Santos Uy specialize in rice bowls. It's a serious departure for Chef Olalia, who previously cooked at places like French Laundry, Qua, and a Patina here in LA. I stopped in earlier this week to find out what it's like for him going from white tablecloths to plastic to go containers.
It's quite a transition. And it just so happened that this 2015, you know, it was just, I was put in a position, do I go back to a restaurant and cook French food, or do I just go on my own and start making food that matters to me? And that's why we built this place.
Okay, so basically I have to say, even though I've experienced Filipino food, I've never tried cooking it myself at home except for adobo. Yeah. So I really take this opportunity of being with you to sort of learn about the ingredients, about the pantry. Yeah. So let's start with maybe taking one of your bowls and then let's just like explode out. So it says here on your menu, choose your rice.
Yes.
Normally that would be a very easy thing, but you have a separate rice menu.
Yes, our rice menu, we kind of treat it like almost like a wine bar menu or a coffee menu, where we actually show the origin of the rice, the variety of the rice, and that's where Santos' expertise comes in, and he describes the rice as if he talks about the grain, the starch level, the chewiness to it. You know, he expounds on it more.
How many different kinds of rice are you bringing in? And I understand you're actually working with a Filipino co-op.
We have two companies that we work with. It's one of them is called Social Products Project. You know, his name is Justin Garrido. He brings in black rice from south of the Philippines, Cotabato. And then the other company is Eighth Wonder. And they work with farmer co-ops from the northern part of the Philippines, the Ifugao region, where they have the famous Bunawe rice terraces. We bring in 10 different varieties, but we only feature three at a time because of the shortness of space, I guess.
Okay, so we can choose the rice. And then it says choose your ulam. What is ulam?
Ulam is your main, it's pretty much your protein, your main entree. So you choose the rice, so that'll be the base, and then you choose the ulam. And the ulam, these are all very classic Filipino dishes. However, what's different about it is that we chose these dishes according to the rice. So since some of the rice is very pungent in flavor, then okay, maybe we can do the longanisa with this. You know, on the first dish we have garlic fried rice. It's very oily, garlicky, salt, very strong flavors. And we pair it off with an even stronger flavor of longanisa, which is flavored with black pepper, spices, and a little bit of vinegar.
So let's talk about longanisa, because I feel like of all the Philippine ingredients, except for vinegar, it's probably the one that most people have heard of the most. So it's a sausage, right?
Yes. It's a pork sausage that we make in-house. This is an heirloom recipe. It's something that my dad's family has passed on for years and years and years. You know, and my uncle and my auntie were nice enough to teach me sometime last year after, can you please teach me? Can you please teach me? There was one that fateful afternoon. It's like, okay, we'll teach you. I'd say it's a hybrid of different regions of Longaniza in the Philippines. Just like any country, it's very regional. Where I'm from, Pampanga, the Longaniza that we have is almost on the sweeter side. But the Longaniza that we make, it's meaty, it's spicy, and there's also sweetness to it. So in the Philippines, there's three regions that are very important. Vigan, which is northern part of the Philippines, and Quezon. And these two are very garlicky, almost like northern Isan sausage type, a little bit fermented. And then the other one is just meaty and spicy. So what we've done is kind of taken all these flavors and put it on one sausage.
But then there's that sourness too, right? Yes.
The sourness of the sausage comes from fermentation and the pickled vegetables that we make in-house. In a Filipino plate, there's always a sour component. In the Philippines, we call it achara. It's just pickled papaya is what it is. And it's the simplest thing, so, you know, in the world. It's just really coconut vinegar and sugar. That's it.
How is coconut vinegar different than all the other vinegars we taste? And what is it that's being vinegared?
I believe it's the coconut water that's been fermented. It's not as acidic as, say, cleaning vinegar or like basic white vinegar. I compare it to French vinegars, like for example, white wine vinegar is what we use for a lot of escabeche and a lot of braises. But the acid level in a coconut vinegar is very minimal, that you can actually use a lot of it without overpowering a dish. And that's what I've learned as the most important ingredient somewhat in the Philippine pantry.
Well, that's really, really interesting. So when we're talking about a cook's mise en place, tell me the difference between what you would have always had your cooks in a French situation have compared to what you have here.
Normally in a French kitchen, in a cook station, you'd find salt, pepper, bay leaf, thyme, and fresh garlic. And for the cooks that are working with me here, it's a big transition for them because on their station here, it's fish sauce, soy sauce, calamansi, which is like a Philippine lime juice, and very little salt.
What was your family's reaction when they heard that you were going to embrace your roots rather than take on another French kitchen?
At first, they thought it was just another phase in my mood swings. But after further explanation of the situation, they're 100%. They're 100%. They're actually my importers and exporters for a lot of my ingredients. And this is true. My mom, without her, I don't know how I can have half of my pantry here. She sources a lot of them in the Philippines, even though she's not into food. But it makes them really happy to be able to help and be a part of something new.
Well, I wish you the best luck. And I love that this is 200 square feet. I do. It's like perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Charles Olalia, who, along with Santos Uy, who's behind the counter over here, are the owners and the chef here at Rice Bar in downtown Los Angeles. Coming up, Jonathan Gold's in the studio with his weekly restaurant suggestion. Find out where we're going next.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
Welcome back to Good Food. Jonathan Gold is here. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. And as usual, I am very curious to know where he's taking us this week.
Well, we're going to Bel Campo in Santa Monica.
We're going to a butcher shop?
Well, there's almost like a steakhouse speakeasy hidden behind the butcher shop and back.
I love this. It's such an odd story.
It is. I mean, Bel Campo is, I guess, first and foremost, a ranch, a 12,000-acre ranch at the foot of Mount Shasta in the way north of California. Anya Fernald is the CEO. Everything is grass-fed. There's no finishing on corn the way they do other places. They have their own slaughterhouse, which, you know, we've talked about it on the show, but that's the biggest problem with a lot of people growing, you know, organic, sustainable meat is that there's not a way to actually finish the animal's life in a manner compatible with its raising. And they use the meat from that ranch to supply, I think it's a half dozen restaurants in California now. There are butcher shops attached to all of them. And now it's here. And the one in Santa Monica is, I guess from the minute that it opened a few months ago, became the Southern California flagship. It's a big, gleaming butcher shop with a lot of great stuff in it. But if you've ever cooked with grass-fed beef, you know that it cooks differently than the beef we're used to picking up at Ralph's or even at a really great butcher shop like McCall's.
Yeah, it's a challenge. It requires just a different set of knowledge.
It does. So to my thinking, the steakhouse is almost like a demonstration kitchen. It's showing people how to cook this particular meat.
Okay, so given that there's this close synergy between the butcher shop with all of its very unusual cuts and the restaurant, what should we be looking on the menu that really gives us a depth of understanding of some of the things that we might have trouble making or that we've never seen before?
One of the important parts of the menu is a list of tartares. There's three of them usually, beef, lamb, and goat. They have the texture of being hand-chopped, whether they are or not, which means that it's not a paste. There's a little variety in the texture of it, and they're subtly spiced, and what you are tasting is the essence of the raw meat. It's kind of beautiful. Some of the dishes you do want is the, I think they call it a French dip éclair.
A French dip éclair.
So they
you have to definitely have to describe that.
They make an éclair size, you know, log of pot shoe. And they slice it and they put rare sliced roast beef in it, a little bit of horseradish, and they serve it with a dipping cup of what is familiarly known as au jus. And the bread is fantastic, and the sensations are very much like a French dip, except it's something that's obviously not a French dip. But I have to say the soul of the restaurant lies in something they call the dinner for two.
Okay.
Which is a big shell steak, although you can get a rib steak if you want. Sort of a big chunk of creamy potato gratin and like a salad with some cherry tomatoes and bacon on the side. It's the sort of thing that you would have gone to a place like Tracton's when we were growing up to get. But the taste of the steak is very different from what we're used to.
How is it different?
Well, there's much less fat. It's lean. And it's cooked very carefully. There's not a lot of huge heat and huge charring on it because that would probably destroy the steak. So it has a sort of a meaty sourness to it that could come, I'm assuming, comes with some age. It comes pre-sliced for you. And if you didn't know what you were looking for, you could think it was sort of a lesser cut of something because it doesn't have that sort of decadent, greasy, oily, I'm eating high on the food chain quality that you would get if you go to like, you know, Mastro's or Ruth's Chris or The Palm. It's a different kind of flavor.
And it has a lot more texture.
That would be one way of putting it.
You need to use your jaws.
It's not the sort of American paradigm of a super soft, you can cut it with a butter knife, you know, held by an infant kind of steak. There's a less expensive version of this steak, which is a steak frite, which will be a different cut every time, usually like a sirloin tip or some not marquee part of the animal. And, you know, of course, the famous Bel Campo cheeseburger, which is every bit as good as it is at the stand downtown.
Wow, sounds really good. Thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Bel Campo, the restaurant in Santa Monica. Text the words good food to 69866, and you'll get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. Indian food. The worst of it is kind of like slop on a plate. But the best of it, the best, is complex, ever-changing, and deeply reflective of the cook's personal flavor choices. So what happens when a Jewish American delves into her passion for spice blends? A restaurant here in Los Angeles called Sambar, the creation of Akasha Richmond. Hi, Akasha.
Hi, Evan.
How are you?
Very good. How are you?
Good. So I have to say, I really love Sambar. And part of the reason I love it is that I feel like it expresses a type of real Indian home cooking that many people haven't experienced. What is Sambar?
Well, first of all, thank you. That means a lot. Really means a lot. Sambar is a South Indian, almost like a dal. It's a soupy bean stew dal dish made from tur dal, or also known as pigeon peas, little yellow beans that are cooked, and it can be made many different ways with all kinds of vegetables, but it usually has tamarind.
Does it also refer to the actual spice blend itself used in making sambars?
Yes, the sambar masala. So that's part of it.
And what is the sambar masala made of?
Pretty much. I mean, one of the things it's made of is it actually has the dal in it. So there's a lot of spice blends where you toast the dal and then you toast the spices and you grind it all together. And when you use that masala or powder into a soup or a dal, it thickens it a bit because the beans, you know, they're almost par cooked and then they're, you know, added again. So it gives it a little body and it adds a flavor. And there's chilies in there and different spices depending on, you know, your recipe.
What has been your culinary journey that led you to this kind of food?
So I lived in an ashram when I first came to L.A. And studied yoga with Yogi Bhajan. But he was a real cook, like a wild cook. He would make crazy things. We went coffee beans into curries and things like you've never seen before. And he was into turmeric 35 years ago, and ginger and spices and black pepper and chilies. So I really learned a lot about using those kind of ingredients from him. And that led me to go to India and just a really lifelong love of Indian food and learning about it. Because it's a lifelong journey to learn about Indian cooking, as you know.
Is there a particular mentor whose flavor palette just seemed to mesh with yours, either an actual person or in the form of a cookbook author?
Well, there's a few cookbook authors. Locally, there's Neelam Batra, her book, Thousand Indian Recipes. Unbelievable. I mean, I'm sure you know the book. You can't go wrong with that book. I think she has some of the most balanced spice blends and curries and just her methods. And if you really read that book, you will learn a lot. And then Raghavan Iyer is a friend of mine, and I learned a lot from him. He actually came out and cooked with me for a week.
Was it hard for you to decide to birth this, knowing that some people would say, what is a Jewish American doing making this food? Who does she think she is?
Yes. And the fact that, as you know, food is personal. And with Indian food in particular, a lot of people have an idea, well, that's not Indian food because they only know chicken tikka masala, let's say, which is not on my menu, in case you haven't noticed. It's a, you know, it's a British dish. I like the dish, but I just didn't want to put it on the menu. So, yeah, there was some hesitation. But I was so passionate about it that I just had to do it.
Yeah. Indian spice blends are incredibly complex because of the quality of the spices, the number of spices involved in a particular blend, and also the extremely personal choices that go into creating what it is that you want to be at the service of your dish. How do you go about choosing what to use?
It is so overwhelming. I mean, and the heat, too. You have to, like, you know, sometimes you have to tone the heat down or you want to tone the heat up. You know, I make things, I taste them, I look at things. I mean, we have about 6 or 8 different spice blends that are our core. It's a little personal for me because, believe it or not, I don't really like cumin, except for the black Indian cumin. I almost always cut the cumin in half and up the coriander.
Okay, you mentioned you have about 6 different spice blends. Could you share with us sort of what the general flavor profile is of them and why you need so many and what you use them for?
So garam masala, most people are familiar with, and it's not just a North Indian blend, although ours is, and it's usually cumin and cinnamon sticks and a lot of times black cardamom, which I love, and green cardamom. So, you know, that's one blend. And that would go into like a North Indian dal or even into some South Indian dishes. I mean,
it's considered to be the sort of more warming and sweeter of a lot of the blends.
It's warm and sweet. It's nice. And chaat masala is just my favorite.
It's addictive.
Addictive. And I like it so much that we have 2 different types that we use because I can't put it on everything. So we do 2 different ones that are both different. One has mint and, you know, they're just different and unique. And it has that black salt and the mango powder and all those sour flavors. And I just love it.
Yeah, I think it's the sour puckery nature of the chaat masala that really makes you just want to pour it on everything.
Everything. And you know what it's really great on? French fries.
Ooh, I've never done that.
Oh, it's so good on French fries. And then you eat the French fries with like a spicy ketchup or a chutney, a tomato chutney. That's the best. Then the other one that we use that I read about and I had to do, it's called gunpowder masala. And I love gunpowder.
Oh, that's another one that you could just eat by the spoonful.
Exactly. It's, you know, the toasted dal and chilies and sesame seeds and, you know, very few other spices. And I just love it. And we use it on fried potatoes and we use it on our uttapam.
Okay, your uttapam. Let's talk about your uttapam. What is uttapam traditionally and then how is yours different?
Okay, so uttapam is a fermented pancake. You take rice and dal, a white or a dal, it's a split shelled bean, and you separately soak them overnight. And a little fenugreek goes into one of them. And then they're blended in the next day, and then they're fermented again overnight. It's a huge process. And I wanted to do something with a twist, of course, and I thought, let's try some quinoa in with it. So we use part quinoa, and Evan, this recipe took a long time. We worked on it over and over and over, trying. I must have tried 6 different rices to get it right because it's hard because sometimes you do it and it didn't ferment right. It didn't have the right flavor. It didn't have the right texture. I really wanted to do dosas at the restaurant. It's a similar batter to dosas, and we just didn't have the room in the kitchen or the flat top needed. But I love that fermented South Indian dosa or uttapam. And then, you know, you cook the uttapam like you would a little bigger. We do ours a little bigger than a silver dollar pancake. Although you could go to an Indian restaurant and it's about 6 or 8 inches big, almost cook like a pizza. And then you can put onions in there and vegetables and all kinds of things. And we put a little of the gunpowder on top.
Yeah, gunpowder with that dosa batter. It's just so good.
So good.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Evan.
Akasha Richmond is a local chef and restaurateur. Her latest venture is Sambar in Culver City. Coming up, would you buy ugly fruit and vegetables? What if they were half the price of the cosmetically perfect ones? We'll meet the man making ugly vegetables sexy next.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
Americans throw away enough food every year to fill 730 football stadiums.
Food waste is like the band Rascal Flatts. It can fill a surprising number of stadiums, even though many people consider it complete garbage. But between producers, sellers, and consumers, Americans are throwing out a third or more of our food. And the amount we throw out has increased by around 50% since the 1970s. At this rate, in 40 years, when you order pizza from Domino's, they'll just deliver it straight to the nearest dumpster. As they should, but that's not the point here.
Everyone's talking about food waste these days. Last weekend, John Oliver joined the conversation with a hilarious yet poignant segment on his HBO show Last Week Tonight. My next guest also knows that humor just might be the gateway to fix tonight. My next guest also knows that humor just might be the gateway to fixing this mess, or at least making a dent. Jordan Figueredo is a food waste activist from Oakland, California, who believes in what he calls, quote, fun activism. His Ugly Fruit and Veg Instagram feed uses images of anthropomorphic carrots and bumpy tomatoes to raise awareness of how much cosmetically imperfect fruit we send to the dumpster. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, I'm so excited to talk to you because it just seems that an ugly fruit and vegetable campaign was just made for Instagram. Tell us how it started.
Yeah, so pretty much I was developing the Feeding the 5,000 Oakland last year, working on that, managing it, and researching, you know, where to get the food for the event because we had to feed 5,000 people. So I learned more about the problem on the farm. And not many people were talking about how much produce was being wasted. And I started seeing these figures, 20 to 40% of all produce before it even gets to the store. And I was just blown away. So I kept racking my brain, how can I do something about this? You know, what's my next thing after these events last year? And I thought, well, look, there's all these funny pictures out there I've seen. Why not start some sort of a social media campaign to highlight the fun aspects of all this produce that's going to waste and sort of reel people in with that, and then talk about the issue and what they can do about it.
What were you doing feeding 5,000 people in Oakland?
Yeah, so my day job is in sort of the zero waste field, working with a community on recycling, reducing waste, and I got involved in industry events. And then last year, I wanted to develop a zero food waste forum with Dana Gunders of NRDC to highlight all the upstream solutions to food waste, not just compost, which is good, but all this good food that was going to waste that could be, you know, fed to somebody or gone, and you can prevent the waste in the first place, which is much better. So Feeding the 5,000, that was the first one in the U.S., but it's had a tremendous impact in Europe. Tristram Stewart, my friend, started it in 2009 in London, and now they've had them all over Europe, now all over the world. And it highlights all of this good food that's going to waste in sort of a positive way, right? Feeding people a meal, talking about solutions, chef demos, education. So it's a really great event to bring people together on this issue that they otherwise wouldn't know anything about.
So let's go back to the ugly fruit and veg. How much produce is wasted just because it doesn't meet supermarket standards?
So the data is not perfect, but the best data we have is the FAO, and they're saying 26% roughly in the U.S. is wasted before it even reaches the store, mostly for cosmetic reasons. There's some other reasons in there, such as labor being a shortage on labor, or there just wasn't a market for it, but mostly that 26% is cosmetic, so it could be too big or too small, or slightly miscolored, slightly misshapen, sun scars on it. It's pretty ridiculous when you consider how much produce is wasted for things that don't affect nutrition or taste.
So let's get to this campaign. What is the Change.org petition about?
Yes, so the Change.org petition we started a little over a week ago, and it's basically asking Walmart and Whole Foods, two of the biggest or most noticeable retailers, to sell, quote, ugly produce in their stores. And it's not just sell it, you know, and like I said, in the back or whatever, it's make a public campaign, raise awareness so people know that this is okay. And yes, it's good for the environment. It's good for society to not be wasting so much resources. So the petition is on change.org. You can go, it's on the homepage too, or change.org/whatthefork. And it talks a little bit about the issue and why it's so important. I mean, one thing I have come across recently that I didn't realize, more than 4 in 5 people in the U.S., or 80-something percent, do not get enough produce. We don't get enough fruits and veggies. So we talk about the issues, and then we call on the grocers to do something about it, because we shouldn't be wasting this kind of food.
So is there a successful example of supermarkets that are selling ugly fruit and veg?
Yes, they're all over. In the U.K., they've actually been selling ugly produce for several years. Actually, 2012, it was the fastest growing market in the produce sector was ugly produce in the U.K. Then last year in France, Inglorious Fruits and Vegetables was a program by Intermarché in France all over their stores, and that was a tremendous success. It was almost a viral success more than anything, but that increased store sales and increased traffic at their stores. Then all these other stores in France followed along. And then even closer to home, Canada has a couple chains selling it, Safeway Canada and Sobeys. So there's plenty of examples in other countries. And now my friends with Imperfect Produce out of the Bay Area are working with Raley's, a smaller but large grocery chain on sort of the West Coast, to sell Imperfect Produce there, which they call Real Good. And it's only been a couple weeks, but it's doing well. And that's the first example in the U.S.
So is one of the reasons that these campaigns are so successful is the price point of the, quote, ugly produce?
I think that is one of the reasons, but part of it is also the marketing of it. I mean, it's an educational piece. It's a little bit of an awareness raising. I mean, if you ever hold up some funny-looking produce, I've done this before in a farmer's market, and people think there's something wrong with it. So you kind of have to educate folks that the stuff that really looks different, there is nothing wrong with it. But the price point is a big deal. I mean, 30 to 50% off perfectly fresh produce. Who wouldn't want that anywhere?
Jordan Figueredo, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You can follow Ugly Fruit and Veg on Instagram and visit his website, endfoodwaste.org, to check out the petition. What's my favorite place to pick up some ugly fruit and veg? Of course, it's the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Let's head there now for our weekly check-in with Laura Avery.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm standing here with Mark Carpenter in a waist-high sea of tomato boxes that are just loaded with different colored tomatoes. Mark, this is your tomato season. Coastal is well known for the multitude of heirloom varieties they bring to the market. Looks like you're in full swing. Tell us some of the varieties you have.
Oh, we do a whole myriad of heirloom varieties, along with a sauce tomato and an early girl tomato. And we're always trying new varieties, too. Every year, we like to try new varieties.
What are some new ones that you tried this year?
I'm getting a lot of my seeds from Italy this year. So I'm trying this new variety right here, Belmont tomato. It's a super sweet red tomato. It looks kind of average, but it's very tasty. Along with like a dozen varieties of experimental heirloom varieties we try.
You also do, you've got the really great 12-pack of all the different cherry tomatoes, purple, white, yellow, green, orange, red. I mean, and they're just gorgeous together. Any new varieties there?
Not really. We kind of save the seed every year. So a few of the varieties are unique to our stand. The green and the brown cherries are definitely unique to our stand. And we kind of know the varieties we like to grow and do well for us. So we kind of year after year grow the same cherry varieties.
There are tomatoes people like, they're called slicers, and then they have the stew tomatoes, and then they have the sauce tomatoes or whatever. And so you're able to tell somebody what to get for what they're looking for?
Yeah, definitely. We do grow like a couple of specific saucing tomatoes, which is like a paste tomato. The early girl is kind of like your average slicer and go-to salad tomato, kind of good for everything. And then all the heirlooms are just probably the top-of-the-line salad tomato.
And the heirlooms, oh, that's because of their flavor. And they're so oddly shaped. I mean, they're lumpy and bumpy, and they're all unique. And how do you cut them and clean them? And are you just slice them up in hunks?
They can be tricky because they are so odd-shaped. But you just need some good knife skills. They're definitely hard to handle, hard to pick. They're easily bruised and poked, and you get a lot of waste when you're growing heirlooms, and that's kind of a shame. And even this last little storm that we had that blew through really kind of messed our crop up. We had a lot of culls that we're throwing out, and like a week ago, I wasn't throwing away any tomatoes, and then this last week, I was throwing away bin after bin after bin. So they're very tricky to grow and very temperamental.
Right. When you have, say, culls or damaged, or if they get bumped on the way down, do you sell those aside for a lower price?
Yeah, absolutely. We separate them by color. We can do like a soft case of yellow-orange or a soft case of red or pink, and the chefs make soups and gazpacho, and we sell it for less than half price.
Okay. All right, Mark, always great to see you and Pranilla and the gang and your sea of tomatoes. It's really, really looking good. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That was Mark Carpenter. He is the farmer at Coastal Farm, and he and his wife from Pranilla are in the middle of tomato season, and it's really something to see. Standing here now with Brian Dunsmore, who was the chef owner of Hatchet Hall, his newest restaurant down on Washington Boulevard in Culver City. And Brian, you've been open just a couple weeks. You've been coming to the market for years. Tell us what you've got on the menu right now, what your special ingredients are this week.
Well, obviously, being summer, corn just came in, and then tomatoes are great right now. I know it sounds like kind of a cop-out, corn and tomatoes in the summer, but that's what we're super excited right now. We're doing a really cool sliced tomato dish, our play on a tomato salad with pigeon peas, soft herbs, and a white cheddar dressing. And we're also doing glorious corn cream to order with bay scallops and brown butter and citrus zest.
When you say cream to order, you mean you're making it when the dish gets ordered by the customer?
Yeah, well, the corn's off the cob and milked with the back of a knife on the cob. And then we're picking it up with heavy cream and citrus juice and zest and salt and pepper, you know, the basics.
And when you say you get the milk out of the kernels, is it a two-step process to get the corn off and then get the milk out or what?
Yeah, so basically we just shave the kernels right off of the cob. And then once all that's off the cob, we scrape the milk off of the cob with the back of a knife into the same container.
Okay, and then do you make a stock with the corn cobs?
We do. We use all the corn cobs to make stock. We have a big walk-in freezer, and one thing I learned working at a restaurant here in Los Angeles was it's okay to freeze stock. So that's about all we freeze. So we have a big walk-in freezer, so we're not wasting anything. Everything goes into the stock cauldron.
That sounds great. And then later in the year, it's going to come out into soups and everything.
You betcha. Yeah. Right now, people are like, you guys aren't seasonal. You're using pickled rams. I'm like, yeah, we're pickling rams, you crazy people.
And they were in season once. So, yeah, and you're hanging on to them. I mean, these things are so short season and so rare. You really do want to have them stick around for a while.
Absolutely.
Well, congratulations on that, Brian. And it's always great to see you and your team here at the market. And sounds wonderful.
Awesome. Thank you, Laura.
That was Brian Dunsmore. He is the chef owner of Hatchet Hall, the restaurant down in Culver City on Washington Boulevard. As always, getting inspiration and great stuff here at the market. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Coming up, we'll talk about the ultimate outdoor food. And no, it is not burgers and does not require a grill. Stay close.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I am so happy when I cook outdoors, and I don't mean flipping steaks or burgers on a grill. There's a ton you can do with a live fire and a large pan beyond the usual American cookout foods. Last month, I watched Chef Karina Weibel of Canalay cook a vegetarian paella over a makeshift fire pit up at Coleman Family Farm in Carpinteria. The process was so beautiful and the results absolutely delicious. I knew I had to find out more. Hi, Karina.
Hey, Evan. How are you?
I'm just completely blown away and fascinated by what you're doing because it is the perfect food to cook outside. And I don't think any of us actually realize what a natural cookout food paella is.
I think it's a perfect campfire food because you always have a fire and you can, you know, all you need is your pan.
So in this case, tell us what the food is you've chosen to put in this pan.
Well, this is a collaborative event here at the farm. And so for the first time, I don't have to do like a protein-heavy paella. So it's vegetarian. It's beans and rice and greens. And it's the Coleman Cavallonero. It's the Spanish rice and the beautiful beans also from Coleman Farms. Very simple.
One thing I love about being here on the Coleman Farm, first of all, is it's the kind of farm where you could just rummage through the fields to find stuff to build anything. So there are many opportunities for ideas for fire pits. What is this one?
Well, this is made out of an abandoned washer, which, you know, they have the holes in it. So, you know, you put in your spin cycle and all the water comes out of it. But it's great if you make a fire in it, it keeps it really well ventilated. And so Romeo cut a bigger hole in there, and it's good. It's off the ground, so you can build a good, strong fire that can cook for half an hour to an hour. And it keeps a really even fire once you get Stan, the fireman, here to build the fire for you. And then just keep it going and move the logs because he's good at that.
That, of course, is Stan Waitman, partner of Valerie Gordon from Valerie Confections. This is a collaborative event we're all at. So I have so many questions. First of all, the wood. Does it have to be a certain kind of wood?
I don't think it has to be any kind of wood in particular. We started because the Coleman Farms, they have a lot of avocado trees, and they had a downed avocado, so it's beautiful to get the fire going. It burns really fast. It smells really good, so it'll make it a good flavor. But then we have oak on there, which will burn longer. And as long as it's not contaminated wood with like pesticides or sprays or anything, you can use any fire. You just have to make sure that it'll burn long enough to keep the fire going to cook the food.
Okay, so the paella itself, one of the things that always intrigues me about paella is that the different diameter of the paella pans creates its own volumetrics, right?
Correct.
So whether you're making a 12-inch pan or a 30-inch pan, it's sort of the same cooking time, right?
Correct. That's absolutely right. And it is, it's very important, like the Spaniards, when you buy a paella pan, how many people it's for, because there's a pan for 3 people, for 5 people, for 7 people, because you want really one layer of rice. If you start to pile it up, you're not going to get the sucaret, which is a crispy part at the bottom, and you're going to have more of a peel-off as opposed to something that's a little bit like infused with the stock or the water, whatever, using the flavors, and the important, very crispy part of the pan that everybody really cherishes.
So tell me how you built it.
Today, again, it's a vegetarian one, so it's pretty easy. Get the pan on the fire, you put the oil in, get that nice and hot. I had a mirepoix, vegetables, diced up vegetables that were onions, celery, garlic, and fennel, and you caramelize them a little bit, add the rice, and make sure you salt it in the beginning. So I had the rice with the oil, and I toast the rice a little bit. I also had cavallonero, so I added that and the beans, and then I spread it all out in the pan, and then I add in the stock, and let it sit for 20 minutes, and then we'll taste it, and it should be done.
And it's covered with newspaper. Why?
Well, the honest truth is about the newspaper. The first time I did paella at my house many years ago, Roxana Gilipet, maybe you know who she is, she was over and she's like, why don't you put newspaper on it? That's what they do in Spain. I said, okay. And it makes sense because it's a hot fire, so the liquid would burn off very quickly. So it kind of helps to steam and cook everything, especially if you're doing proteins, if you're doing, you know, shellfish or shrimp, chicken, rabbit, all the things. You want them to kind of stay steaming in there as well as cooking. And it always works. I haven't killed anyone yet.
The rice. Tell me about the kind of rice that you prefer to use.
I use the arroz bomba, which is a Spanish rice, and I get it from La Española. And it's a shorter grain rice, but it has a beautiful starch to it. I've never overcooked it, but I think it'll never fall apart. It has a really nice toothiness. It's similar to risotto. And if you don't have arroz bomba, it's hard for you to find. You could make a paella, I'm sure, with risotto. Or also like the Japanese short grain rice, the koshikihari, makes a good paella too.
Is there a rule of thumb visually as to how much liquid you add?
Yes, but I don't know what to tell you that is. You don't want it to overflow. You want everything to be coated, and you want to see it pooling on the top.
Barely pooling, right?
Barely pooling on the top, exactly. You got to see everything kind of floating up.
So for this 35-inch pan, how many people is this supposed to be for?
It's supposed to be for 30 people.
It's so fantastic. Do you do this often?
Yes, I do, but I haven't done it enough lately because I think it's a great thing to do in the summertime, but it's a really wonderful thing to do in the wintertime, like at Christmas time to do, like, you know, if you want to do the Siete Mares, it's really great to do a seafood one right around Christmas time. Anytime is good. Like, you just have to get the fire going.
And I mean, what's the worst thing that could happen?
Get up. You know?
Which in this case means stir it, because I noticed that ever since you put the rice in and the additional ingredients, the beans and the cavolonero, and you gave it a good stir, there has been no stirring.
There's been no stirring, because if you stir it, you're not going to get the crispy bits on the bottom. So it's really, you have to have that fave.
How do you know when it's done?
Yeah, when I make it, for some reason, it's always like between 20 minutes and half an hour. And if you're doing proteins and you want to make sure, of course, like all the proteins are cooked. Somehow, like I said, this rice is very, very forgiving. So you're never going to have overcooked mushy rice. So it's about the proteins. And in this case, we want to make sure that the rice is not too crunchy. So I'm hoping that it steams in there and it keeps cooking and that I have enough liquid in there and I have the crunchy bits, but I also have the bits that are creamy too.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. It's been just such a serendipitous occasion. I'm so happy we got to talk.
Thank you, Evan. It's always nice to see you. And I'll see you at Canale.
That was Karina Weibel, chef owner at Canale in Atwater Village. We've been talking about what I think is the perfect summer cookout food, paella. It's that time in the show when we talk about pie. We've actually been roaming the halls at KCRW asking our esteemed guests about their favorite memories of pie. When we bumped into comedian Jonah Ray, this is what he had to say.
I grew up in a town called Kailua, which is on the windward side of Oahu in the island chain of Hawaii. We're still part of the States, so contrary to popular belief, we still have your mainland pie, as you call it. But we have an ingredient that no one uses anywhere else, which is haupia. Haupia is a gelatinous coconut treat, which is indigenous to the islands. And it is the ingredient in the best pie I've ever had. And it was a chocolate pudding haupia pie with a very thin flaky crust. And on top would be just the right amount of whipped cream.
That's comedian Jonah Ray. You may recognize his voice from the Nerdist podcast. He also co-hosts Comedy Central's The Meltdown with Jonah and Kamal. And in case you aren't convinced on haupia, let him try to persuade you.
I guess the best way to describe it is midway between Jell-O and pudding.
That sounds like a possible contender for a cream pie filling. Bakers, don't forget to enter your pie in our 7th annual Good Food Pie Contest. All the details, including how to enter your winning pie, are at kcrw.com/pie. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. Thanks to everyone who works on Good Food. That's Jillian, Laurel, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan, and I'll be back next week with more good food.
Papa was a rolling stone.